He had expected to die. Not in battle, which would have been simpler, but later, quietly, through a trial, dressed up as law. That was the future he imagined when he backed Pompey. Now he walks again through Rome, past the same columns, the same men and women, and nothing has happened to him, at least nothing visible. The city is calm, though it does not feel the way it once did. Conversations carry on. Greetings are exchanged. Businesses resume. Yet a certain carefulness shapes how people move, how they speak, how long they hold each other's gaze. The war is over, but something has stayed behind. Victory has been achieved, and still the outcome feels incomplete.
Welcome to the Members in the Room podcast, where we share real-life stories about leadership and their underlying human behavior rooted in science and research. We unpack and interpret the evolutionary forces behind it to help you to better lead your people for outstanding business results.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Members in the Room, where we explore leadership lessons that stand the test of time, using history and neuroscience to explain the human behavior behind pivotal decisions, because those same patterns still shape how leaders and teams succeed or fail in organizations today. I'm Nicholas Bocconi, CEO of Mammoth Leadership Sciences. In the last episode, we followed Julius Caesar to the moment when delay was no longer possible, and the crossing of the Rubicon turned tension into open conflict. What followed unfolded faster than most in Rome had anticipated. Italy did not hold. Pompey withdrew, hoping to regain control elsewhere, yet the rhythm of the war never returned to him. Caesar moved quickly, securing Spain, and then pressing into Greece, until a decisive encounter at Pharsalus broke the last organized resistance. Pompey fled and was killed before he could rebuild his position. With him disappeared the one man who might have balanced Caesar. What remained of the opposition scattered, surrendered, or made their way back to Rome under very different circumstances. By the time the fighting subsides, Caesar stands without a direct rival. What he returns to, however, is not empty. The man who expected to die now takes his place again in the Senate and finds himself listening more than speaking. Around him, others do the same. Some had commanded armies, others had shaped policy, and many had believed they were defending the Republic itself. Now they sit together again, their positions restored and their lives spared, trying to understand what that truly means. No one announces the change, yet it is unmistakably there. A proposal is raised and voices follow, measured, careful, almost rehearsed, so that the discussion moves forward while the outcome seems to settle before it is fully argued. The process continues, though something within it has shifted. He notices it in himself first. There was a time when he would have challenged directly, pressed harder, tested the argument. Now he pauses, not out of fear exactly, but out of calculation. He weighs not just the idea, but the room, the reactions, the presence that sits just beyond the center of it all. Because he is there, Julius Caesar, who does not need to intervene. His influence travels ahead of him, shaping direction before words are spoken. Some men lean toward it instinctively, others more cautiously, but few ignore it. It becomes easier to align early than to resist late. And so the system continues. Magistrates hold office, courts function, and the Senate meets. From the outside, Rome appears stable, almost unchanged, and for the broader population, that continuity matters. Trade resumes, the noise of conflict fades, and life begins to feel predictable again. Inside the room, the experience is different, very different. The man who expected to die begins to understand something he had not anticipated. Survival comes with a cost. he has been spared, allowed to return, permitted to continue, yet that permission does not feel neutral. It sits with him, shaping how he speaks, how he listens, how he chooses to engage. Gratitude exists, though it does not stand alone. It is accompanied by caution, by awareness, by a quiet recognition of how easily things could have ended differently. Others carry the same weight. One senator speaks too quickly and then adjusts mid-sentence. Another remains silent throughout, his presence noted while his voice is withheld. A third aligns openly, his loyalty now clear, though it had not been before. Each navigates the same reality in a slightly different way. They are still part of the system, yet the system no longer belongs to them in the same way. This is the moment where Julius Caesar makes his next move. He does not purge the Senate or dismantle the Republic. Instead, he allows it to continue. And within that continuity, he extends clemency so that former enemies return, retain status, and resume roles that would have been lost under a different kind of victory. It stabilizes the city quickly. There is no cycle of revenge, no immediate fragmentation. Order returns, and with it, a sense that Rome has endured. From a distance, it looks like restraint, even generosity. Up close, it feels more complicated. To be spared is to remain inside a system where someone else now defines the limits, which changes how you act, how you think, how you position yourself. You learn where the edges are, not because they are stated, but because you feel them. The man who expected to die understands this clearly now. He is alive, he has a seat, and he has still his voice, but he no longer uses it the same way, and he is not alone. What emerges is a kind of order that holds without settling. Decisions are made, institutions function, and the Republic continues to present itself as it always has. Yet beneath that surface, alignment has shifted from belief to awareness. People do what is required, though they do not always believe in it. From the outside, Rome is stable. Inside, something has been quietly redefined. And changes like that do not disappear. They wait. Next time, we follow Julius Caesar further into power, where control becomes more complete, fewer voices are heard without hesitation, and the distance between authority and reality begins to close in ways that cannot be managed indefinitely. All right, what does this leave us with as modern leaders? If you want to take away only two things from this episode, it would be these. First, when you inherit a divided environment, do not assume that restored roles mean restored alignment. Pay attention to how people behave, not just what they say. If you notice hesitation, over-calibration, or silence where there used to be challenge, address it directly. Create conditions where people can engage without calculating personal risk, or you will end up managing compliance instead of commitment. Second, understand that how you treat former opponents shapes how your system evolves. Offering restraint can stabilize quickly, but it must be followed by deliberate work to rebuild trust. Without that, you create a structure that functions on the surface while carrying unresolved tensions underneath. I was once brought into a company as an outsider to lead a huge department through treacherous times of change of a big merger. This department consisted of two opposite groups of the former singular companies or entities. And boy, were they fighting against each other. Not outright, not from a unit perspective. In fact, these two opposite fronts were mixed into the same teams, same goals, incentives, purpose, etc. But make no mistake, although in the same team, there was a cultural war going on. There were winners, there were losers. I was technically hired by the winning or new group, and I felt it. No one trusted anyone. Everyone was weighing his or her own actions, words, ideas against everyone else. No freedom of thinking, zero psychological safety. Yet, from the outside, everything was running smoothly. systems were retained. Work went on as usual. Everyone was, quote-unquote, friends with everyone. That was a reality. And you felt it every step of the way. Fully functioning from the outside. Completely artificial from the inside. It took our team, my leadership team and I, 2 years to sort this out. Whenever you encounter a situation like that, as a leader or as being part of a team, think about it in that way. The question for leaders is not only how to win, but what kind of system you are left with once you do. All right, this was it for today. If this episode resonated with you, whether as a leader, a student of history, or someone curious about why power unfolds the way it does, please subscribe, rate, and share it with someone in your network who would appreciate this kind of perspective. And lastly, if you're interested in more, you can order my book. It has the same title as this podcast, The Mammoth in the Room. It offers a practical roadmap for how great leaders and their teams embrace evolutionary truths for outstanding business results. And it does that in three sections, on people, on strategy, and on implementation. Until next time, lead wisely, think critically, and don't let ancient instincts quietly hijack your modern leadership. I'm Nicola Spocconi, and this is The Mammoth in the Room. Thank you for listening. If you enjoy this content, don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you on the next episode of The Mammoth in the Room.